Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, October 22nd. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, opening Ontario.
This is a cautious plan. It slowly lifts public health measures over time, allowing us to monitor any impacts on our hospitals and in our communities.
Canada's most populous province is lifting capacity limits on most public venues that require proof of vaccination starting on Monday, saying hospitals are secure and well under capacity, and plans to keep those vaccine passports until at least mid-January. Is the province on the right path, or do reduced restrictions risk a winter surge? In moments, we'll break it all down with a panel of Ontario mayors. Then, cutting off supports. The government gave just 3 days' notice that broad business supports will be replaced with targeted programs over the weekend. Was that enough notice? Are Canada's businesses ready, or are we in for shuttered main streets across the country? We'll bring in the Chamber of Commerce and Canadian Federation of Independent Business. And a somber anniversary. 7 years ago today, a gunman killed 24-year-old Corporal Nathan Cirillo as he stood guard at the National War Memorial before charging into Parliament Hill's center block. Our press gallery reflects on that tragic day and the heroes who protected everyone in Parliament. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. The great reopening continues with Ontario announcing three key dates today. Up first, on Monday, capacity limits will lift in most settings that require proof of vaccination. Then, if the health system remains stable, the province wants to start lifting proof of vaccination requirements on January 17th. And finally, the province is targeting March 28th to lift all remaining measures, including indoor masking. So, is this the right path forward for the province, or are we at a risk in winter? Let's bring in a panel of Ontario mayors to dig into it. Burlington Mayor Marion Mead Ward and Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley. Welcome, mayors. Thanks for joining us on this Friday afternoon. Mayor Bradley, I want to start with you. Do these new rules make sense to you?
Well, I think the fact, Joyce, there's a plan. I think that most mayors, most citizens of Ontario would welcome that. I think it's a risky plan. I think it is cautious, as the Premier said. I do believe there'll be some setbacks because we're into some uncharted waters here as we move forward, as the different restrictions come up. But I think it gives hope to people, and that's what they need right now. When you look at all the other things happening around the world, you look in our own country with inflation, you look at all the things that are happening that with the end of the CERB and those programs, this at least gives people a path forward. And I do, as I said earlier, believe, though, there will be some setbacks, and we still are dealing with a very serious health situation. But again, I think it's methodical, I think it's orderly, and if it has to change as it unfolds, that's fine. But at least it's a plan.
Mayor Mead Ward, Mayor Bradley just said it is a risky plan. What do you think about it?
Well, I think it's a light at the end of the tunnel, first of all, for people to start seeing that there might be a day when we can reduce the take off our masks, hug each other again so we don't have physical distancing bylaw, and possibly eliminate the vaccine mandate. However, January, February is when this is supposed to start happening, and that was right in the middle of the lockdown last year. And as we headed into the worst wave that we have seen through this pandemic in spring. So I think we need to be really, really careful and make sure that the data, the science, the health indicators, the hospital capacity, the infection rates suggest that that's the time to do it. And I think it's going to be soon. And, you know, I've always believed that you set a longer target, and if you can lift things sooner, that gives people hope. But, you know, we don't want to have to keep extending this if the situation is different. But let's hope, you know, let's hope that by then all of the measures that we've all taken, the sacrifices over 18 months will pay off.
So, Mayor Bradley, I'm curious about why do you think Premier Doug Ford feels compelled to already lay out dates when vaccine passports won't be needed to enter public places and a date for the end of masks? Now, are you not kind of worried that, you know, anti-vaxxers will say, all I have to do is wait a few more months and I can fly under the radar? Is it wise to give deadlines You know, we know he's lifting the restrictions, and that's a good step. Why also give deadlines for masks and proof of vaccination?
Well, I think it's important for the 80% of the public that's vaccinated in Ontario and have done the right thing. I think it's important that they know there's a reward for doing that. Yes, the anti-vaxxers will use this. And the one downside of this is I hope that this does not stop people from getting vaccinated, thinking, okay, this is going to be changed in a couple of weeks, couple of months, so I don't have to do this. I hope this will keep pressure on people to get vaccinated because they can't access these places in the next few weeks and months without that vaccination proof. Look, it's risky. I'm not a big supporter of this government. It's not my philosophy or politics, but I think they're doing the right thing in the right direction. And I will not be critical if they have to change parts of it during this, because no one's been in these uncharted waters before. So, yes, there'll be critics and there'll be people saying, well, this should have happened earlier or it should happen later. But I think it's worth at least having this plan to get us through the winter, because, you know, none of us thought a year ago, if we were talking, that we would be talking about these restrictions today. We thought they would disappear with vaccination. That hasn't been the case. So we need to keep on pumping that word hope. This is about hope. And let's hope that we are out of this. Let's hope we can dance at weddings come this spring.
Well, yes, no, I'm with you for the dancing, Mayor. But, you know, Mayor Mead Ward, so, you know, capacity limits in restaurants, for instance, full capacity opened with vaccine checks at the door. Do you think that these restaurants are going to get full right away? Do you think people will still hesitate, or will they think this is too soon?
Well, certainly we've seen a slow return to all of the activities that we used to love. There are still a lot of people that I talk to who are fully vaccinated, who are reluctant to eat in a restaurant, have only done it maybe once with immediate family. So people still have a hesitation of whether it is safe. And I do have a concern. I think Mike raises some really good points. And I do have a hesitation around lifting the vaccine mandate. Look, they're not new. We've had our requirement for our kids to be vaccinated to go to school. There have been international mandates for vaccines for decades now. And the fact that we have the vaccines has allowed us to come out of lockdown to see a time where we can hug each other and dance and go to those things. If we lift the vaccines too soon and we don't get that critical mass, I think we're in for some difficult times. So I would rather keep the vaccine mandate for a longer period, maybe lift some of the other restrictions sooner, and then see where we are beyond March even and into spring.
So I want to shift to, you know, government aid programs. So if these businesses, now that we can fully reopen at full capacities, if these businesses are still struggling and are failing, should they still get federal support? And for how long? You know, Mayor Bradley, I don't want to be cold-hearted because obviously, you know, this has been a tough time for business. But on the other hand, you know, Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, announced another $7.4 billion on top of the $268 billion. So for how long, once we reopen and we go back to ish normal, should these aid programs last?
I mean, the fact is, Joyce, that a lot of these businesses right now are dog paddling. They're just keeping their heads above water. They're paying the hydro bills, and that's about it. I can't answer that question in the sense of timing. I can say that I think that the programs that were put in place, as imperfect as they were the right thing to do. And the fact that, in general terms, business and labor came out and supported them and still do to some degree at this point. I think we need a transition period to get us into the new year to see, particularly in Ontario, how these changes the Ford announced today, are if they're making a difference. There is great apprehension of going out to restaurants, but where the Ford government got themselves in a real box was when they decided to let people go to hockey games and baseball games in great numbers. They could not continue to penalize the restaurant business. Yeah, there's a lot of fear still about going back out into your community and doing those things. I'm hoping this will help move this forward with the right safety protections, and that includes the masking and all the other things. Those support programs, I am very apprehensive. The day they do end, you're going to see a lot of businesses across this country from sea to sea go under, because that's all that was keeping them going through these very difficult times.
So I'm wondering if you have a comfort zone. I only have a minute left, but I'd like to ask both of you. Is there a number of cases where you're going to start thinking, okay, we're going to have to shut down, we're going to have to reimpose restrictions? Do you have those numbers already in your mind? Mayor Mead Ward, I'll start with you. I mean, there must be a point where you say, now we're okay, we see the ICUs that are functioning well. What's that number? Where do you see that maybe re-happening this winter?
Well, we have a framework. We have those thresholds of hospital capacity. We don't want to see canceled surgeries. We know that we have another health pandemic that has grown alongside this one, with people not being able to get the timely care they need because our ICUs were filled with COVID patients. So we need to look at that indicator, the positivity rate. All of those indicators have already been laid out in the framework. And I think there's no reason to set those aside. If we start hitting those again, that's when to pull the brake. And I know that the government will do that. They've done it before. And certainly we would be advocating as mayors if we saw those indicators going the wrong way. But our medical officers of health would be advocating for a shutdown as well. So I know all of us are going to be watching this, and we'll do the right thing.
Mayor Bradley?
I agree totally with Marianne. She's covered everything that I would have said, and said it much better than I could have said it. So totally on board.
Two mayors that agree. That's wonderful. Mayor Mead Ward, Mayor Bradley, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Have yourselves a lovely weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joyce. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Bye.
And coming up, the feds are extending a lifeline to businesses to get through the fourth wave. However, these new supports will be targeted to select sectors. Will some Canadian businesses fall through the cracks and have to shutter their doors before this new aid gets doled out? We'll speak to the Canadian Chamber of Commerce's Perrin Beattie and the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses, Dan Kelly, next. Don't go away. And welcome back. The pandemic is not over, but some federal pandemic aid will soon be. As of tomorrow, businesses will lose out on accessing the federal emergency wage and rent subsidies. They will be replaced by the Tourism and Hospitality Recovery Program and the Hardest Hit Business Recovery Program. The new Tourism and Hospitality Recovery Program will allow hotels, restaurants, and travel agencies who lost revenue by an average of 40% in the past year to have wages and rent subsidies up to 75% until March 12th. After then, that aid will be cut in half until May 7th, 2022. As for the businesses in other sectors, the hardest hit business recovery program will subsidize the wages and rents of businesses that lost an average of 50% in revenue. Those subsidies would also be cut in half after March 12, 2022. That's a lot to take in. A benefit that survived the acts was the Canada Recovery Hiring Program, which will be extended until May 7, 2022. Will these new targeted support programs leave some businesses to fall through the cracks? And remember, all of this will require new legislation in Parliament. Can businesses afford to wait for the House that doesn't even return until November 22nd? Let's ask Perrin Beattie, the president and CEO of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, and Dan Kelly, the president and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business. Gentlemen, welcome to Power Play. Very nice to see you.
Hi, Joyce.
You know, Dan Kelly, let me start with you. We all knew that the emergency COVID-19 support programs would be temporary, but the government only gave, you know, Canadians 3 days' notice for these new changes. Is that enough time for businesses to pivot? And really, didn't we actually know that this was going to happen?
You know, it is a relief that the government has announced the extent of the creation of some new programs to replace the old programs that are ending. Gosh, it would be great if they could give us a few more days of notice when they do such things. It causes panic on the part of business owners. I spoke to one who was in tears, trying to figure out which of their employees they would lay off and which ones they would try to keep. But Joyce, I got to tell you, I'm worried. The bar to access these programs is super, super high. You just pointed out, if you're a restaurant that has a loss of one third of your revenue, you get zero. If you're a gym that has had a 40% loss in your revenue, you also get zero. And so they're ripping away these subsidies pretty darn fast at the point where we still have considerable numbers of restrictions in place right across Canada.
Perrin Beattie, you know, Parliament doesn't return until November 22nd, and the government will have 3 weeks to pass legislation before the winter break. Can businesses survive the wait? You know, you've been in Parliament. You know how things happen and how slow they can be. Can businesses survive the wait?
What's going to be critical, Joyce, is that all members of Parliament set aside their partisan differences and work together in the public interest here. There's been a commitment made. It's important to deliver on that commitment and to do it as rapidly as possible and to give businesses the certainty as to what they're dealing with. That can be done.
Dan Kelly, you know, as of Monday, a restaurant in Ontario, for instance, can operate at 100% capacity with people having to show proof of vaccination, of course. But if they are still struggling or are failing, should the government continue to support them? I know you're going to say yes, but, you know, Chrystia Freeland announced $7.4 billion this week. There's $286 billion already out there. You know, at one point, sadly, it's going to have to stop. So when does the government decide that we're reopened, you're on your own?
Look, no one wants these programs to end more than me. Business subsidies are stupid. They make no sense in ordinary times. But the reason that we have these subsidies in place is because we're asking businesses to either shutter, limit themselves, or limit access to their businesses in some considerable ways. Vaccine passports, love them or hate them, has meant that most businesses in those sectors are not able to serve another 15 to 20% of their customer base as a result.
But they will. They will. But Dan Kelly, they will. My question is, once we're at full capacity, I understand until now, look, but once we're at full capacity, how long then do you continue supporting businesses?
Joyce, we do need to continue the programs for a bit longer. Our view is that we need to see the end of every single COVID restriction before we can say to businesses, you're on your own. That means we have to end the capacity controls, and Ontario took a big step forward, as you noted today. That is good news. But we have to have all of the lockdowns, all of the restrictions in the rearview mirror, including vaccine passports, masking rules. All of that needs to end. Then we'll start to see customers begin to return to businesses. But even now, if you can believe it, 19 months into the pandemic, only 40% of my members are at regular levels of sales. 60% of them are below water. Are we going to tell them, I'm sorry, it's time for you to just to fly on your own? If it wasn't for the restrictions, I would say we could end these programs quickly. But, you know, public health officials tell us we're just not there.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I don't want to sound heartless. I'm just wondering, you know, because this, you know, adds to Canada's debt. But, okay, Perrin Beattie, I want to ask you this, because there is a labor shortage across the country. For instance, in Ontario, it's 300,000 job vacancies alone. I think a little bit shy of 200,000 in Quebec. So that's a lot of help wanted signs here. So has the government missed the mark on these new programs? Should they have targeted job training, recruitment, immigration? I mean, it seems that, you know, at the same time these businesses are struggling, they need people to come and work. So where do you draw the line? How do you fix that?
It certainly is critical. We're hearing it right across the country. It doesn't matter the size of the business or the region or the sector. It's extremely difficult for them to get the people that they need. The government made a tough political decision in terms of pulling back on some of the supports they were paying to individuals to encourage people to go back to work. There's much more, though, that we need to do, whether it's in immigration, whether it's training, reskilling, a whole range of other areas that business has to work very closely with government to be able to meet our needs for the future. We had a labor shortage prior to the pandemic. It's become more acute since then. We all have to roll up our sleeves and go to work together to make sure that we can supply the people that we need.
Yeah, it is going to be an interesting fall and an interesting winter. Gentlemen, thank you so much. The Canadian Chamber of Commerce's Perrin Beatty and the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses' Dan Kelly. Gentlemen, have yourselves a wonderful weekend.
Thanks so much, Joyce.
And we have an update for you now from Iqaluit on the city's water crisis. The city has been in a state of emergency since October 12th when staff confirmed evidence of fuel contamination in the city's treated water supply. Residents have been told the water is unsafe to drink, even if it's filtered and boiled. City officials are now confirming the source of that contamination. Listen to this.
We do suspect that contamination from the soil or groundwater outside the plant has seeped into the water treatment plant, into the affected tank. So an environmental site assessment, phase two, a subsurface investigation has begun. We are expecting to drill samples early next week. We'll take subsurface soil and groundwater samples from outside the treatment plant and on the site. The next steps will be dependent on testing results, and we will take direction from our experts on actions required to remediate the site.
And earlier today, the federal government announced Canadian Armed Forces members will be deployed to the community to help deliver clean drinking water. And stay with us. Just this summer, the Liberals called an election saying Parliament had become toxic. Now they argue $7.4 billion of pandemic aid can be passed in just 3 weeks. Are we in for a whole new House of Commons? The strategy session digs in next. Stay with Power Play. And welcome back. A number of federal emergency aid programs will expire tomorrow. The Canada Recovery Benefit will be replaced by the Canada Worker Lockdown Benefit, which will provide $300 a week to workers subject to a lockdown. Programs aimed for businesses like the Canada Emergency Wage and Rent Subsidies will also disappear tomorrow. The feds will bring in a Tourism and Hospitality Recovery Program and a Hardest Hit Business Recovery Program, where eligible businesses will get a portion of their rent and wages subsidized. These new targeted support programs will come in at a price tag of $7.4 billion. The government has only given Canadians 3 days' notice about these changes, and Parliament will only have 3 sitting weeks to pass new legislation after they return on November 22nd. Yesterday on Power Play, Employment Minister Carla Quattro said that the government can pass the new legislation in time. Listen to this.
Here's the problem. One, Parliament doesn't get back to the 22nd. And then two, you got 3 weeks to do it. Can you get this legislation introduced, passed, and done in essentially 3 weeks?
We absolutely can. Certainly, we've shown that in the past, working together with the opposition, that we can get these things delivered quickly for Canadians. Any benefits we introduce will be retroactive to the last day, so until, I guess, November 21st. So there won't be any benefit disruption for Canadians.
But in a minority government, are the Liberals playing political games with a vital COVID aid? And in the meantime, could they be leaving vulnerable Canadians and businesses in the lurch? Let's take that to our panel of strategists. Greg McCachran from Proof Strategies leans Liberal. Adrian Batra, the Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief, brings the conservative voice. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director and needs no introduction. And Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategy Group has a nonpartisan perspective. Hello, Friday Strats. Nice to see you.
Greg McCachran, I
want to start with you. The House will have to legislate these new support programs for businesses. The House returns on November 22nd, as we said earlier. They will have 3 weeks. Now, you know, was this a way to rush it through Parliament? And what's the political strategy here?
I'm only supposing that the Prime Minister is giving Erin O'Toole more time to get all his MPs vaccinated before the House comes back. That could be, you know, I'm just speculating. That's lots of time to get work done. But, you know, there's this assumption about the previous parliament that I heard a lot on this show during the election, that the parliament was working really well. But last December, Minister Freeland introduced a bill around her fall economic update. By February, she was pleading with the opposition to stop the procedural and delaying tactics. It didn't get passed until May. The Conservatives actually voted for it, but it took 6 months to drag through. So it's really going to be up to the Conservative opposition whether or not they want to get these things done and help get Canadians back to work. It is really up to them. I mean, they can talk about this, but you remember the nursery rhymes that Pierre Poilievre and other MPs were doing? I don't think that's really what we need. So it can be done, but it's a minority parliament, and the opposition is going to play a key role.
Yes, but we went into an election because Justin Trudeau said it was the parliament was toxic and obstructionist, and we heard Carla Quattro just now saying, oh, yeah, we can get this done in 3 weeks. But I want to ask you, Adrian Batra, because there are 300, despite the fact that they will debate the $7.4 billion and the aid to businesses, there are 300,000 job vacancies in Ontario alone, almost 200,000 in Quebec, and the government is doling out another $7.4 billion as, anyway, this province is reopening. Does this make sense, or should these be different programs now that we're probably walking out of the pandemic?
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah,
Adrian Batra, what? I don't know if you can hear us.
I lost
us.
Contact.
Oh, Adrian Batra can't hear us. So let me ask you this, Anne McGrath. Will the Liberals get the NDP support for this piece of legislation?
Well, we've been opposed. The NDP has been opposed to cutting these benefits for sure at this time. I mean, we have, let's remember that when the pandemic started, more than half of Canadian workers didn't even qualify for it. We are supposed to be moving towards an improved EI system that would actually capture a lot of this. But in the meantime, in the absence of that, what is going to happen here is that hundreds of thousands of Canadians are going to be cut off from benefits that they need, and they're being replaced with benefits that actually most people won't even come into effect, like the lockdown one. Nobody will qualify for, because there are no actual lockdowns. But the pandemic is still on. I mean, just this week, we saw the Saskatchewan health officer break down in tears about the status of the COVID crisis in that province. So the pandemic is still on. Hundreds of thousands of Canadians will be cut off benefits that they need. And I think they're being replaced by a myriad of programs that don't really make much sense and won't help people.
Oh, so I just by what Anne said, Greg Wesson, I'm hearing a sort of debate here in the House of Commons, and they only have 3 weeks to do so. 3 weeks is maybe in our life a very a long time. In parliamentary, time frame, it is super fast. Things happen very slowly on Parliament Hill. We all know that. So can this be done in 3 weeks? And was it wise for the Liberals on such important help to individuals and businesses to come back on the 22nd of November and expect this to happen in 3 weeks?
Well, Joyce, I guess the clearest thing we can say about all this is let the games begin. And I think what we're hearing is the beginning of those games. Look, if they had all party support for passing that legislation, they could get it done in a couple of days. I mean, the parliament can do whatever the parties decide. If the Liberals had come back earlier, I think the debate would have just lasted that much longer. It's going to be an interesting showdown, and that's really what it's going to be, is whether, first of all, parties will agree to pass the legislation. What are they going to exact from the government in return for that? Or if they're not passing it and we head into brinksmanship, as you said, there's only 3 weeks in there, and if they don't pass it, what is going to be the cost to the opposition parties of being the ones who effectively will be denied those payments going out? So that's the showdown that's going to happen, and we'll just have to wait and see which parties blink first.
But, you know, Greg McCowkin, there will be another showdown as well, because we've got now the House of the Board of Internal Economies, who has decided that anybody going into the House of Commons has to be vaccinated. We know that some of those MPs from the Conservative parties are not. We don't know how many. Is it three? Is it two dozen? We don't know. But we know they're going to contest that. So the showdown for the $7.4 billion in aid is one, and the showdown about vaccinated or non-vaccinated MPs will also be another headline. How do you see this playing out?
Oh, an old rap song comes to mind when you say showdown. I hear throwdown. Hell no, I won't go down. There is a big problem for Aaron O'Toole on this. I'm hearing that he's done interviews where he said that he has it under control. I think there was a meeting perhaps between he and I believe the leader of the Bloc where he said that he had it under control. It's going to be an issue unless the answer is 100%. And if he doesn't have 100% of his MPs vaccinated, he will be answering questions every day. Encourage your viewers to check out Leslyn Lewis's Twitter feed. She doesn't seem to be very happy about, she's a Conservative MP, doesn't seem very happy about revealing her vaccination status. I would, you know, also mention that Althea Raj from the Toronto Star wrote a long form piece 2 weekends ago where she said during the election, it could have been as many as 20 Conservative MPs were not vaccinated. So until he's able to say 100%, he will still have this as an issue.
And, you know, how do you get this issue, sort of off the books, so to speak? I mean, it seems to me that there are important issues that the House has to, you know, grapple. And here we are with a few Conservative MPs. We don't know how many. Are they 20? Is it 12? Is it 6? That, you know, we'll get bogged down with this debate when, in fact, you know, we don't have a lot of time before Christmas to help those people out there who need help. So how do you fix this issue?
Well, Mr. O'Toole is in a completely untenable position right now. So the way to deal with it is he has to tell his MPs that they must be vaccinated. You know, maybe they don't accept the authority of the Board of Internal Economy or any other authority, but he is the leader of the caucus and he has to tell them that they must be vaccinated. The problem that he has, of course, is that he is also fighting for his leadership, and that won't go down well in terms of being able to get the support of the members that he convinced he was a very, very solidly true blue conservative and then turned out not to be that during the campaign. So, I mean, that's the political problem that he has. He's got on the one hand the leadership where he has to prove that he is like this completely right-wing social conservative true blue, and then he's got the caucus that he needs to keep under control, and those members who are creating this problem for him are making it almost impossible for him.
So Greg Weston, we went into an election because the House of Commons was toxic and obstructionist. We're going into, a new session. Are we risking another toxic and obstructionist session?
Joyce, what I'm going to say is going to hurt the ears of every Canadian voter in this country. But the reality is we're in a minority government. And so, you know, the next election campaign has effectively become. Nobody knows when the government will fall. No one knows when that would happen. So this is going to be, we will not have a long period of everybody playing nice in the sandbox. This is going to be loud. It's going to be ugly. And, you have to feel sorry for Canadians who really need these things. And they're sitting there saying, oh, my God, how long are you people going to debate these things before you're going to act? And that's what's going to be in the faces of the opposition parties. But the government has a problem. It's going to have to probably put some water in its wine as well to get that legislation passed. It will get passed for sure. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It's just a question of how much the country will have to sit and watch the show first.
Well, there certainly will be a show and a showdown about vaccines, Greg Mack, because, we're still, the issue is not going away, and it won't go away until November 22nd when they all come back and we'll find out how are they going to manage this. And in the meantime, you know, as Anne says, rightly so, there still is a pandemic. So are we going to get bogged down with those conservatives who don't want to get vaccinated? Or will this parliament be able to get down to business?
I think it is a case, you know, we're pretty tough on our politicians in Canada, but this is a case where they can walk and chew gum at the same time. I don't think the issue of vaccine hesitancy from an elected member of parliament should supersede the business of parliament. They've got to get things going. I think both Craig and Anne have rightly said that, there's a fatigue around this. No one wants to hear about parliamentary privilege when we're all showing our vaccination status to get into a sporting event or go to a restaurant. Canadians just won't have the time for it. So what it means is that the Conservatives, if they're in a story, it's going to be one of their own making around vaccinations. I live in Ottawa. It's a city of about 1 million people where 90% of the people here have at least one vaccination. So, you know, it is a small minority that these Conservative MPs who are not vaccinated are with. And I don't think Canadians have a lot of time or willingness to listen to their views if that's their view on vaccination. They'll be listening to the Liberal caucus, the NDP caucus, the Green members before they listen to Conservatives.
Well, it will be a short session, but an interesting one. Greg McCachran, Adrian Batra, unfortunately, we lost her. Anne McGrath and Greg Weston, thanks again for being there on Friday. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks.
And coming up, Canada remembers a fallen soldier and a day that forever changed Parliament. 7 years ago today, Parliament was locked down after a gunman killed Corporal Nathan Cirillo before storming into Parliament's center block. We talked to two journalists in the press gallery about the lasting impact of that day. Stay with us. Hello and welcome back. Canada remembers Corporal Nathan Cirillo. 7 years ago, the 24-year-old was gunned down at the Canadian National War Memorial. He was standing guard on ceremonial sentry duty at the memorial. A lone gunman shot him before entering Centre Block. He died after being shot by officers in the Hall of Honour. It's a moment that forever changed Parliament Hill. As parliamentary journalists, we continue to remember that day 7 years later. I'm joined now by the press gallery. Susan Delacorte is a columnist with the Toronto Star, and we have CTV National News senior political correspondent Glenn McGregor. Welcome, colleagues, on this Friday afternoon. Glenn, what are your memories? Because you were here. What are your memories of that day?
Yeah, I wasn't actually in Centre Block where my office was when the shooting occurred, but I was heading there, and I was stopped outside by the Confederation building by police, and we knew something was up. And we listened in on the radios the police had on their bodies, and we heard this sort of rising level of chaos and confusion. Stories were going around. We were trying to get as much information as we could through our cell phones, but the networks were jammed. So we didn't know, first of all, how many gunmen there were. We didn't know if the incident was continuing to go on. I mean, it was over very quickly, as we know now. But on that day, it was utter confusion. We thought maybe this was an assassination attempt aimed at the Prime Minister, and still, you know, depending on how you interpret it now, that may have ultimately been the objective. But it was just a lot of, I mean, we call it terrorism for a reason. It was a lot of terror. And I remember standing there at Bank in Wellington at one point hearing three loud bangs, and the police just freaked out and started yelling everybody to get back. We all ran down onto Spark Street. Turned out to be some noise from a construction site. But it just kind of puts in perspective like how little things on that day, we had no idea of how to interpret them. And of course, we were all very worried for our colleagues. I worked in the hot room in Centre Block with a lot of other journalists. I didn't know if they were getting out. I couldn't reach them. So it was, an extraordinary day and a really awful one, Joyce.
Yeah, that defines chaos. So, Susan, how did this change Parliament?
Well, you know, it's almost sad that Centre Block is now closed down, because there you could go up there and actually see where the bullets hit. I think all MPs and anybody who was there at the house that day. I think it gave them the idea that you know, we like to think of ourselves as a very innocent country, and there, you know, where things like this happen in the United States. But in some ways, it was almost a precursor to what we saw happening in January back in the United States. We had that moment of terror happen here. And we've also seen security is much tighter now on Parliament Hill, but also we have the sense now that our politicians are not as safe as they used to be, that there have been other incidents. And, you know, I'm talking to you here from a neighborhood a block or so away from where a man drove a truck through the gates of Rideau Hall not too long ago. We saw those scary protests during the election campaign. You know, you don't want to draw a line between them causally, but you do want to remember that politics is not as safe a business as it used to be in Canada, and being a parliamentarian can be scary.
Yeah, a little bit of loss of innocence, isn't it? You know, I want to change topic here and talk about cabinet, because Tuesday we know the new cabinet will be sworn in, and that is all we talk about on the Hill. And now the guessing game has started, I know, and we're all hoping we'll get as many right names as possible. It will be a little bit of musical chairs and obviously some, you know, new faces. So, Glenn, let me start with you. What are you looking for on Tuesday?
I'm looking for a bigger cabinet, first of all. I think this is going to be the most difficult cabinet shuffle that Justin Trudeau has faced since he was elected in 2015 for a couple of different reasons. First of all, he has to maintain the gender balance, and he's lost essentially four women from cabinet. Three were defeated in the election campaign, and another, Catherine McKenna, chose not to run again. So they have to be replaced, and he also wants to increase the representation of people of color in his cabinet. And he has some different regional things he has to consider now, because he has, unlike in 2019, he now has two elected MPs from Alberta that he's got to put at least one of them in cabinet, and we can talk about whether or not he thinks he'll put both in. So the mathematics of it are very complicated. So I think really the only solution is that he's going to have to add some more positions in the cabinet. He's going to have to grow the size of the cabinet. And also, quite possibly, he's going to have to ask some veteran cabinet ministers to possibly leave. We think maybe that Jim Carr, who was in there as a Western Canadian representative from Manitoba when they didn't have representation in Saskatchewan or Alberta, we think maybe he will voluntarily step aside. But there's some other hard choices they're going to have to make. They're going to have to make a decision about where Harjit Sajjan goes. We think he's almost certainly moving out of defense. We don't know where, if he's going to stay in cabinet, move to another portfolio. There's just so many different permutations and combinations that people in the Prime Minister's office, I bet, are still crunching right now.
Susan, what's your take on next Tuesday? What are you looking for?
Well, first, before I look forward, I look backward, right? And this Prime Minister has used cabinet shuffles in a really interesting way to react to things. The successful cabinet shuffles he had were a reaction first to the election of Donald Trump and then to the election of Doug Ford. That's the Donald Trump cabinet is the one that made Chrystia Freeland the person she is today. Then he did the cabinet shuffle in the beginning of 2019 that was about housekeeping, about Scott Bryson leaving and then solving some personality problems, et cetera, et cetera. And we know where that led. You know, how many times do we hear in 2019, if Scott Bryson hadn't left, we wouldn't have had all those problems. So that's all to say that this Prime Minister uses cabinet shuffles to signal what is the biggest thing on his mind at the moment. And if he's, so I'm going to be watching, is he using the cabinet shuffle to respond to big things in the world? Climate change, reconciliation, the ongoing pandemic future, like he did with Ford and Trump, or is he using it as a housekeeping exercise to fix problems on the inside? One type of shuffle has worked for him, the other one has not. So it's possible it can be a bit of both, but I think it's going to be interesting to see what he does because of the way he's treated shuffles before.
Glenn, I have a theory, but I'm sure we all have a lot of theories, and speculation is running rampant in our world. But you know, this is a parliament that, you know, hasn't really changed. The seating arrangements is pretty much 2019. This was an election. We're still wondering, why did we have an election? It seems the same faces are back. So you're going to need something different in this cabinet. You're going to need fresh faces. You're going to need something to show that the election and all this postponing of parliament wasn't a total waste of time. How do you see him managing the bringing in the new faces without kicking out too many of the loyalists?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be that many new faces, to tell you the truth. I mean, Trudeau has been in power for 6 years now, and he's worked with the cabinet for that length of time. He knows what does work, and there's people he has around him that he trusts. And I think, given the fragility of his government, he's, you know, just scraped through with two minority elections. I think he's going to want to have a cabinet that he feels stable. He's not going to put people in important portfolios unless he's worked with them for a long time. I mean, we know who the people that he really has a lot of confidence in. Obviously, Chrystia Freeland, Mark Garneau, François-Philippe Champagne. He feels very comfortable with those people, and I don't see him bringing in any rookie MPs, for example, even though he's going to try and balance that gender diversity thing. I don't think he's going to put anybody in those positions that is going to be put him in jeopardy.
Yeah, it is going to be a challenge, and we'll know on Tuesday, so that's great. Susan, Glenn, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. And that's your Power Play Day in politics. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back right here on Monday. Have a safe and happy weekend.